Man, I have decided when I grow up, that is the voice I want to have right there, you know? Like, y'all come here, come to the conference, be like, I got to go home and preach with my voice. I don't know about that. So, good stuff. So, hey, my name is Jason McGuire. I'm the Executive Director of New Yorkers for Constitutional Freedoms. I am the President of New Yorkers Family Research Foundation. I also oversee New Yorkers for Constitutional Freedoms Political Action Committee. You'll find us at newyorkersforlife.org. You'll see us at New York Alliance Against Assisted Suicide. You know, you're going to see lots of titles and lots of names in the stuff that we do. And frankly, we have to have all those different organizations and acronyms because of the work that we're involved in. We have to separate those purposes for IRS purposes, frankly, tax issues, and to make sure we keep everything straight with the government. So you'll see lots of different titles in what we do, and I realize they're a mouthful, but that's why we do it, is we separate for those issues. All right, well, let me just start by saying that we exist to influence legislation and legislators for the Lord Jesus Christ. We want to be an influence not only on the laws of the land, but also the hearts of our elected officials. Now, how many of you have never heard of us before? We're fairly new to you. You're not real sure with what we do. Show of hands. All right, good. Most people know us and know what we do. At least you think you do. All right, so that's a starting point today. I won't have to delve too much into what we do then, but suffice to say that I'm a registered lobbyist. And what that means is I have to pay a fee to New York State, and then they can call me a lobbyist, okay? Because this is New York State, so they'll tax even the lobbying activity. And the other thing I have to do is New York State requires that I take ethics training from them. Let that just sink in for a minute, all right? So I have ethics training from the state, and I have paid my fee, therefore I am a lobbyist, according to New York State. And you have to do that. In fact, I have to track all of my interactions now with elected officials. And so when I'm lobbying an elected official, I've got to keep track of what issues I'm talking about, what elected official I'm speaking to, and I report all that to the state, where it falls in a black hole and nobody ever looks at it, but I have to do it, all right? Welcome to being small business in New York State. And so those are some of the things that we deal with as an organization. But, you know, let me just kind of back up for a minute and just help you to hear our heartbeat about what we do. I said that we exist to influence legislation and legislators for the Lord Jesus Christ. We want to be an influence on the laws of the land because whatever a governmental jurisdiction legislates, future generations will, generally speaking, believe is morally correct. Whatever a governmental jurisdiction legislates, future generations believes is morally correct. And so the law is a powerful shaper of what future generations will do and will obey and what they'll believe is right. That's important for us to understand. Because sometimes in the Christian community, we can be so withdrawn from the action of government and of the world around us, right? We can focus solely on what we say is the gospel or solely on prayer, and we can focus on those things, and we forget that a part of loving our neighbor is actually being a part of watching and being a part of influencing what's happening in this world as well. And so that's a fine line that I understand that as believers we have to walk, but I believe it's a necessary one. I grew up in Calvary Baptist Church, Depew, New York. Pastor Jim Kester first, then Pastor Carl Longwall, for those of you who know those pastors. And those are kind of my background and my history. I came to know Christ when I was 10 years old, attending a drive-in movie theater, of all things, where the Alden Mennonite Church had a drive-in movie theater, and they showed a Christian film. Like, I think it was Thursday nights before the weekend series began. And I gave my heart to Christ at this drive-in movie theater that our church went to as an outreach. Shortly thereafter, I sensed the Lord's leading my life to full-time Christian ministry. I didn't know really what that was. I just saw a pastor stand up and shout at the front, and that sounded a whole lot more fun than sitting down. And so I went off to Bible college. And I was pretty intense that I was going to be so focused on my studies and not be distracted in any way. And I did real well until the first day in the registration line. All right? Because in the registration line, I laid eyes on the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. I later married her, which always puts women at ease when I say that, all right? It's like, man, what's his wife think about that, you know? But I married her, and her name was Lori Beckley. For those of you who know the Beckley family, Harold and Jean, Ken and Sarah Beckley are some of the missionaries in Mali, West Africa. And so on the first day in the registration line, my wife is talking to an older married student named Rick McGuire. Some of you may remember Rick, right? Right? And Rick was an older married student. He had come to Bible college actually after his retirement, had entered into retirement, went into ministry. I was a young, dashing student at that time. And now, why do you laugh at that? All right, yeah. And so in the registration line, Rick and Lori Beckley at that time, as she went by, were in a conversation. And I wanted to have a conversation with Lori, but I didn't know how to begin the conversation. But I saw the name tag this guy was wearing said Rick McGuire. And I looked at mine. Mine said McGuire too. And I thought, So I just kind of walked into the conversation like this, and my name tag showing next to Rick's. She's already talking to him. He was all interested in the missions work she was involved in, and I was of a slightly spiritual status at that time. Wasn't as much into the mission work, but I was interested in Lori. And so they're talking, and Lori assumed, because of the name tags, that I was Rick's son. And so that worked out real well for a long time, and we eventually had to tell her this wasn't my dad. The wedding reception was a little rude awakening, but, you know, it all worked out. But, you know, over time, we got to know each other a little bit and spend a lot of time together. And I got to know her parents and have Sunday dinner at their house in Vestal. And I got to learn more about missions work and really began to seek the Lord's leading in that. After about 2 years, Lori Beckley went back to West Africa. And I had no choice but to go on a short-term missions trip at that point. And so I went out to West Africa, and I determined in my heart that I would propose to her before I came home. So the last night before I come back from Mali, West Africa, was the night I chose to propose to her. I picked a night I'd never forget. It was Super Bowl Sunday. And we went out to dinner at this beautiful Chinese restaurant in Bamako, Mali, the capital city. And yes, there's Chinese restaurants everywhere in the world. And, you know, cute little side note, her dad used to take her to this restaurant as a little girl, and I didn't know that. But she has fond memories, of course, of her dad taking her to this Chinese restaurant as a little girl and growing up. Whenever they went to the big city, you know, he would take her there for a night out. And so we went to that restaurant. I took 6 years of high school French. And so I know just enough to be dangerous. And I had determined that when I proposed to her, it would be a certain way. And so in my mind, there was this full moon in the African sky. There was the sweet smell of fragrant spices wafting through the air. There was the white sandy beaches along the River Niger. And I pictured there that I'd be standing there in my, we were wearing grand boubous, these matching very ornate African robes that we had made while we were out there. And so there I am in my robe and my chiseled frame as the gentle breeze, you know. And I pictured it this way. How many of you know that life doesn't always turn out exactly as you plan, all right? And so we get out of dinner, and I call a cab with my 6 years of high school French, and I'm trying to describe where I want to go, and I can't tell her where I want to go, really, but I'm trying to convey it. And the cabbie is just driving around and around and around, and he's never really getting to where I want. And so at one point I just said, just stop, stop. And so he stopped. And you know, again, I'm reminded, life doesn't always turn out exactly as you plan, because as soon as I opened the car door, it was not the sweet smell of African spices that filled my nostrils, but it was this putrid odor that that was there, just rank and nasty. And I don't know where the moon went. It had been out earlier that night, but suddenly it was gone. We were near a bridge. That's why I had him stop, and I knew there were white sands down there. I just couldn't see them, and I could hear a little bit of something like water. I figured there's a bridge. There must be water. And so I, you know, couldn't see my hand in front of my face. I honestly don't know where the moon went. It's not like, you know, cities when there's no moon, there's no light. So lest I propose to the wrong woman, I grabbed her by the hand and I didn't let go. And we went down to where I thought the river's edge was, and I got down on a knee and I asked her if she would serve the rest of our days. Would she serve with me? And she said yes, and I think she started to cry, and I'm not sure, I couldn't see. And as soon as I popped the question and she gave her response, I heard a rustling in the bushes nearby. Now, I'm in West Africa, and there's a rule in West Africa. You either run or be eaten, okay? And in my mind, I pictured this being a rhinoceros that was going to stampede over us and kill us both. And I thought that would be the headline, right? You know, I thought maybe it was a lion that was prepared to pounce on us. And then I realized, you know, I'm down by the water. It's probably a hippopotamus, which are not cute, hungry, hungry hippo things. They're not like that. They're nasty, fast creatures that will just snap things in half. And so this is the night in which I now determined I would die, right? And so I thought, you know, we probably ought to get out of here. And so I, again, took her by the hand, and we got out of there. And that night, we're back at the mission house in Bamako. And I'm describing to my African brothers there what has just happened and how we have almost died this night of our engagement. And I'm going through the harrowing story of how I rescued my soon-to-be wife and kept her from imminent danger, and just talking and going over the scene in my mind and describing it to these brothers, and they're laughing the whole time. And I'm getting quite offended now because we have a little cultural divide going on here. It's not appropriate to laugh when someone is going to die, right? And but they're laughing at me, and so I said to them, I said, why are you laughing? And they said, oh, Brother McGuire, we're not laughing because you were going to die. We're not laughing because you were going to be eaten by a lion or because you were going to be run over by a rhino or you're going to be, you know, bitten in two by a hippopotamus. We're laughing because you don't know it, but you just proposed to Lori on the capital city of Bamako, Mali's garbage dump, all right? Which some people say was a little foreshadowing of a future ministry in Albany, all right? You know, I'll let you be the judge of that. But life doesn't always turn out as you plan, right? And so we thought we were going back to Mali, West Africa as missionaries. That was our heart's desire. We had met with Evangelical Baptist Missions, who was in existence at that time, about the possibility of going out to serve in camping ministry, which is also a part of my background. I served 10 years in summer camp ministry. I loved every moment of it. I wanted to go out to West Africa, thinking we'd be starting a camping ministry. EBM wanted to start something along those lines that was just really taken off in West Africa. And so we were intent on doing that. At the same time, this church, in fact, it was Loren's mom, she goes by Loren today, Loren's mom's church had actually been asking me to candidate there as an assistant pastor the whole time I was in Bible college, and I kept telling him no. And, you know, just I just didn't think the timing was right. I just told him no, and 2 weeks before we were supposed to be married, I lost my job. And so I had to call my father-in-law up and say, hey, Dad, I have no hope, no home, no future, no nothing, you know? But we're getting married in 2 weeks. Isn't that great, you know? And he was very gracious, but you know, it was pretty clear I needed a job, too. So at that time, this church called again, and they said, we understand that your employment situation has changed. Would you be willing to reconsider? Have you ever felt the call of God in your life that maybe isn't quite the still small voice, right? But sometimes God just takes your situation and says, you dummy, you know, like, what do I got to do to get your attention? And it was one of those things where for 2 years I put it off, put it off, put it off. And God was just like, fine, I'll, like, here, here's your circumstance. This is where I want you to be. And so we told the church, we said, look, we'll go there for a year. We're gonna, you know, we're headed to the mission field, but if you'll agree that we can come for a year, you keep looking, and if we can fill that gap for you for a while, we'll do that. And they said, okay, fine, wink, wink, just come for a year. Well, a year turned to three, and three turned to five, and you know, after 5 years, I'm having this conversation with God, going, God, I, you know, I thought we were going to the mission field, and here I am. And Lord, I just want to be a place of influence for you. And I never really had settled in to believe that that was a place of influence. And so God had to deal in my heart in that way to say, you know what? Man, where I've called you to serve in this portion of the field, this is your place of influence. And I, you know, I repented of that, and I began to settle down and say, okay, Lord, that if this is the place where you have me serve, then just help me to do this. I want to be here for 50 years. How many know that life doesn't always turn out like you originally planned? Because just as I began to settle down to say, Lord, fine, if this is it, I love this, and I love what I'm doing. It's not that. I'll be here for as long as you have me, and I'm content here. Let's do it for 50 years. God upended the apple cart. And God began to put a burden to my heart for state government and for national government, but really I was beginning to work with state leaders. One day I was sitting in my study at the church, and I got a little card in the mail that said there'd be a town hall at Prattsburg Town Hall. And this is back before town halls were cool, by the way. And so I saw that little card, and I, you know, kind of pitched it, and then I got convicted because I'm supposed to be praying for those people in authority over me, and I didn't even really know their names. And so I just felt that little prick in my heart, and I grabbed the card, and I read the names, and I thought, I should probably go to this. You know, I can do it. I mean, I'm a pastor. I got flexible time, and so I went to this meeting on this Thursday, and the card said they'd be there from, like, you know, 3:30 to 4, and so I got there a little early, and I went in the town hall in Prattsburg, and there was three chairs set up in the middle of the room, a little circle. And I knew my senator was coming, my member of assembly, and so in great faith, they believed one more person would show up, you know? And so, you know, I took a seat. About 3:30, the car pulls up. Out steps my state senator, out steps my member of assembly. They walk into Prattsburg Town Hall. They look shocked. Somebody's actually there. We all sat down in our three little chairs. We had a conversation for the next 5 minutes. After about 5 minutes, my state senator, my member of assembly kind of looked at each other, gave themselves that international body language sign that it's time to go, and they began to get up. I looked at my watch, and I said, the card said you were here till 4. We have 25 more minutes. They both just began to sit back down, right? That conversation led to a series of future meetings where whenever there was a town hall, I started going to these because I realized that no one else was. And I realized that as a pastor of this congregation, I had a tremendous opportunity to be an influence on these elected officials. And so my conversations with them began with concern over things like embryonic stem cell research and the definition of marriage and some other state issues that were being dealt with at that time. But it quickly began to grow into really, I had an authority to now speak into their lives as we built a friendship and a relationship over time. And so when my senator's daughter was getting married, and my children were very small at that time, I could say, Senator, what's it like to have a daughter getting married? How's that feel? Oh, you know, it's expensive. I said, yeah, I mean, you have a poor senator's salary. I don't know how you're going to do it, you know? You know, when my assemblyman went in for hip replacement surgery, I went up to the hospital to see him. And so I work into the hospital, and I get in there, and he's laying there. I learned some cool things about elected officials. When they have surgery, they have to wear that same little robe with the opening in the back that the rest of us do, you know? I thought it was like the golden robe or something, you know? But they wear the same robe as we do. And so I walked in to see him, and his eyes got real big. He looked at me, he goes, what are you doing here? I said, well, I heard you're having surgery. I came up to pray with you. He looked at me. He sat up in his bed. He just started pointing his grubby little finger, you know, this little pudgy little finger at me going, you are the only lobbyist that will come here when I can't run away, you know? And so, you know, and I we had a great conversation after that. We talked about sports and life and prayed for him and just began to build that relationship even more. You know, over time, you build relationships with people, right? It's true of your elected officials as well. You know, because many of you, if not all of you, serve in rural ministry somewhere in the state. Some of you may be in urban areas, but you're mostly rural churches as I look around the room, right? You have tremendous opportunities to build a relationship with people. You know the challenges that you can't just be a pastor or a church member who just pops into an area and is going to spend, you know, 3, 6, 9 months and move on to the next church. You're not going to build relationships that way. Rural ministry in particular takes a long time to build deep relationships. But the rewards are immense because those relationships go so much deeper than in many places of ministry today. Where I pastored, and I was there for 11 years, I kind of had an in because I ended up pastoring the church where Loren's family was from. And I married into the Pressler family in Naples, which of course, you know, let's just say in the church where I served, I really had to check birth certificates closely before I married anybody, all right? And so, you know, I got into the family really well through that way, and I was very well connected because of the family relationships. You know, and I remember, like, first time I had a funeral there, it was for a 15-year-old boy who died of a gunshot wound. Rocked the community. Our little school calls us up, says, we need counselors. Would you be willing to come, Pastor? Can you imagine that today? I can't either. But yet in that day, and it wasn't that long ago, I'm a terribly young man, help me out here. But they actually called up and they asked for pastors to come in. I remember going and listening to the school-provided counselor, and I'm in this auditorium full of these kids, and they're weeping, and they're just, they've lost, he hadn't died yet, but the gunshot had occurred. And I'm listening to this, and the counselor had no hope at the front of the room. I remember at some point I just walked up to the front, and I just began to preach in this public school. And nobody dared challenge it, right? Because I had now had an authority through being in this community being able to do those things. And now every year when that anniversary comes, I still see that reminder to pray for that family and to reach out to them and how you doing. Man, we're literally talking decades ago now. But that relationship is still there. People still remember that. I remember I was struggling, and this, think not less of me, depending on where you stand on this, but in the church, the town where I pastored, there weren't a lot of options for food establishments, and the local pub was where they actually had the reception following the funeral. And I remember as a young pastor struggling with what, if I could even go there, and you know, like, what's this? What message will this send to my to church and to people in the community? And so I decided I would go, and I walked through the threshold of the door, and I just prayed it would not be struck by lightning. And I walked in, and I'm talking to the family, and they're having, you know, kind of the reception thing there, and I'm talking to the father of this young man who's died, and I had the funeral at our church, and now the reception they have over here for the whole community. And I remember walking up to where he was standing. It was next to the bar, and the bartender looked at me, and she goes, "What can I get you, Rev? Can I get you a drink?" And I said, "Well, yeah, can I get a Coke on the rocks?" You know, and you know, and she kind of laughed, and it kind of broke the ice. But man, the opportunities I had, because I was able to maintain who I was and my faith and my beliefs and my convictions, while at the same time willing to sit with the publicans and the sinners, if you will. I almost don't even know why I'm sharing that with you today, but I hope that somebody needs to hear that, because it goes back to relationships with elected officials. The Bible says that Jesus would sit with the tax collectors, the publicans, and the sinners. There's a group of people that are pretty despised in our culture today, and it tends to be elected officials. And not they haven't worked to earn that reputation sometimes, right? But they're really a pretty lost and lonely people. As much as they are financially well off, they get paid pretty well for their jobs, and they usually come out of office better than they went in, it's a lonely position. A member of assembly serves 150,000 people in their district. A senator serves 330,000. We're just talking state assembly and state senators. If you were a U.S. senator, Charles Schumer, Kirsten Gillibrand, you're representing 20 million people in this state, right? At least in theory, representing them, right? Imagine, and to those of you who are pastors here today, you know the demands of a congregation on your life each week. And you know that no matter what, you pick up the phone or the email or Facebook or whatever, someone is going to have a need, and they're coming to you with something they need. And so much of your ministry is about what they need. Well, can you imagine as an elected official, every time someone talks to you, you represent 150,000, 330,000, 20 million people, every conversation you have is something they need. I need you on this bill. I need this. I need you to be here. I need that. That can be very demanding. And it creates relationships that really, they aren't real friendships. And even when you think these people are your friends, they will turn on you on a dime. And so it's very lonely to be in elected office. I know that because our Bible study in the Capitol that meets on Tuesday mornings, believe it or not, we have more Democrats from New York City that are now attending than even upstate Republicans, which is a change for us. It hasn't always been that way. It is encouraging. Now, it's not to say they're not all, they don't all know Jesus, and their voting record reflects that. But they're coming, just like people come to our churches for lots of reasons, right? And so as they come to the Bible study, I listen to them talk about their relationships with particularly the governor, and it's rough. And I know that in recent news, the governor broke up with his live-in girlfriend, Sandra Lee, and now he's living in the mansion all by himself, you know, which sounds, you know. This summer, there was a hashtag on Twitter called hashtag Summer of Andrew, because he was just driving around by himself alone all the time. Like, people would see him down the ice cream stand, and there's the governor, you know, driving in his GTO. He's kind of a gearhead, and he'd be driving around by himself, and he doesn't have very many friends, and it's a lonely role when you're in that position. And so I say all that to challenge you as people in these places of ministry to think about having a relationship with your elected officials. I know many of you will say, boy, you know, I pastor a small church. I can't imagine they'd ever want to come or want to spend. No, they do. And they will. In a political event today, if you have 50 people, that's actually considered a pretty good event, okay? And there's a lot that are smaller than that, some that are bigger, but that's actually a pretty good event. And so if you have an event set up where on some Sunday you want to bring in your state senator, your member of assembly, and if you can get 50 people there, if your church is smaller than that, combine with a couple other churches, and bring them in on a Sunday night or another night of the week and begin to build that relationship and just say, hey, we want to pray for you. Or you know, maybe you're the pastor of the church, and you call him up, and you say, look, you know, I just heard Jason McGuire speak recently. He was talking about you. Said, you know, I should be praying for you. And man, I'm thinking about that. And so I'd like to know, can we have breakfast sometime? Or maybe can I get lunch with you? And I just want to talk to you and know, how can I pray for you? And how can I pour into you? And I believe God calls us to do that, and I just want to bless you. I don't want to ask anything from you. I just want to get to know you and know if I can pray for you. They'll probably take you up on that. Kirsten Gillibrand regularly attends a Bible study in Washington, D.C. The former presidential candidate, right? Kirsten Gillibrand, our U.S. senator. And I look at that voting record, and I don't understand that for my pro-life, pro-family convictions. But I acknowledge that she is going to a Bible study and that she is listening to God's word. Cory Booker actually referenced it in the last Democratic debate. They're at the same Bible study. It's taught by a Bible-believing man. And they're just coming, and they're attending. That's not by accident. And so we have opportunities to water that seed that's being planted in their hearts. And I want to challenge you to do that. Now, can I segue for a few minutes now? And I kind of laid out our heart for our ministry, and I like to do that first because I want you to understand that our greatest need is spiritual, not political. I think you agree with me on that. If not, I'm going to preach a different message, all right? But, you know, that's where we want to begin. And I want to make a hard turn to talk about some matters of legislation because time is short. So here's the thing. I lost more votes in 6 weeks of this year than I lost in the 12 years prior to this combined. First 6 weeks of this year, I lost more votes than the last 12 years combined. Here's what happened. Last November, and for those of you who don't know, we have a Democratic governor. We have a very handily controlled Democratic assembly controlled by New York City Democrats, whose values tend to be quite a bit different than mine. And then in the state Senate, there was the slimmest of margins, a Republican-led majority, which had a ton of problems. They weren't perfect. You may remember our Republicans allowed the vote on gay marriage some years ago. That was a Republican effort that did that. So they're not perfect by any means. But all of a sudden, we're realizing how much, and we knew this, but everybody's seeing it, how much they blocked in that legislature. And how many, they were the firewall that blocked a lot of bad stuff. Last November, there was a blue tsunami that came through New York. And what I mean by that is that the last election, everybody knew the Senate was at a tipping point. And if Democrats showed up in large numbers, then we lost the Senate, a lot of things changed. And if Republicans could hold on, okay, status quo for a little while longer, but the numbers in New York are changing rapidly. And so last November, essentially, Democrats turned out to vote like it was a presidential election. It was nearly presidential numbers. They were just very motivated to come out to vote, and they were very activated, and they showed up, and they voted in large numbers. And frankly, Republican, conservative, you know, independent voters that aligned with us didn't. There's just a lot of apathy. And so our voter turnout was very low compared to those of the Democrats. And by the way, I'm nonpartisan. I long for the day when all political parties will be pro-life. I just recognize it's not true today. And so that caused a major tipping point in the state Senate to where instead of it being like 32 to 31, we're always in the bubble and I can probably break off a couple of people and hold the vote, we zooped to a 38 Democrat senators in the state Senate. And now it's outside the wiggle room of where I can pull one or two away to block a vote. I don't have a single pro-life Democratic state senator, and that party controls everything in the Senate right now. So in January, a lot of things changed, and it changed in a hurry. Some of you are aware that the Abortion Expansion Act came to pass in January. Horrible. Late-term abortion legislation that removes medical protection for babies born alive. We're not just talking about adding it in some legislation or trying to maintain it. New York went the other direction. They took medical protections away from babies born alive. Here's how they did it. Prior to this, it would be required to have two attending physicians at these types of late-term abortive procedures. New York State said, not going to require that anymore. It's just going to be one attending physician. So if you are the attending physician and you've now had this abortive procedure, where is that attending physician going to attend to? The mother on the table who can probably file a lawsuit if something goes wrong, or the squirming baby on the metal table that frankly is being left to die? And if you doubt that, listen to Governor Northam's comments from Virginia to figure out how they're going to handle those types of situations. That's the reality in New York State now. New York State took the word abortion out of the criminal code. So what we mean by that is there is no way, there is absolutely no way to bring a charge against a man today or a woman, I guess it could happen, a woman-woman crime, for criminal abortion. So in other words, if a man assaults a woman and she is injured in some way, then they could probably bring an assault charge or something like that. But if you're sitting in a bar and the man slips something in her drink and there's a forced abortion, but there's no other assault or no other crime that's occurred, then he can walk away scot-free on that because we no longer have criminal abortion in our penal code. That's the law in New York State. We are looking at it in January, we're probably going to have a vote on assisted suicide in 2020. The numbers are razor thin again on that issue. And so in January or February, and they're probably going to front load the legislative session again starting next year, we're probably going to see a vote on assisted suicide. And that's a tough fight right now. Because you and I understand that God is the giver and taker of life. But we're living in a culture that doesn't readily accept that and rather worships autonomy above all other things. My body, my choice. Until you get to vaccinations, by the way. But you know, right? But it's my body, my choice. And so we have this issue that's rising up on assisted suicide, and it's going to be a tough fight because the culture does not accept that basic Judeo-Christian view of life. And so, you know, we have things on the table in the back, and there's lots of literature out there I'll leave out there for a season this morning. We're talking about the Reproductive Health Act, Governor Cuomo's Abortion Expansion Act, what it actually did. I encourage you to grab that. There's petitions you can sign to, you know, repeal it, and it's not going to happen overnight, but we think it's important that we continue to remind people how bad that bill was. I've got literature on assisted suicide, because my other challenge to you is you got Sanctity of Human Life Sunday coming up in January, right? And many are going to take a sermon, you're going to deal with abortion. That's great. It's going to be the one-year anniversary of this horrible thing in New York where people should be talking about that, reminding our people in our pews that this doesn't just go away. It's an awful thing that's happened. But it's also a perfect time to remind people that to be pro-life isn't just the beginning of life, but it's also the end of life. Our polling indicates that about a third of the time we lose people who self-identify as pro-life on the assisted suicide issue. And I believe that's happening because we're not speaking on that subject. The church has gotten very good about talking about the sanctity of human life regarding abortion, but we're always playing catch-up, and we're doing it on the issue of assisted suicide right now. Think of the last time you heard a message on assisted suicide. Probably never, right? And so I would challenge you to think about helping your folks to work through those issues, to have a message maybe on the redemptive purpose of suffering, and that God is the giver and taker of life, and that even in the darkest days of our lives, there is one who walks with us through that, and here's why we take this view, and to remind people that, you know, it's not just about the individual here, but what are we doing as a society with this message? With teen suicide rates always on the increase, especially in the last number of years, why now do we want to tell society as a whole that certain suicides are acceptable while others are not? And that's what we're doing with assisted suicide. We're saying, well, if you're this or that, then, you know, this in this situation, suicide's okay. You can end your life, but oh no, don't you dare think about doing it over here. That's horrible. Don't do that. It's a mixed signal. And if you look at states like Oregon that have assisted suicide, you'll see that their overall rates of suicide go up once you legalize assisted suicide, because there's a mixed message. And we need to be speaking to those issues. I tell people that a part of our ministry is a prophetic ministry, which don't worry, I know some of you right away sat up and went, oh no, he said prophetic, you know? It's speaking to the cultural issues of the day. You know, we forget when we read through the minor prophets that it's not just the foretelling of the future, but they spoke to the cultural issues of the day, issues of justice and mercy, those who were oppressed. Don't you think God would want us to speak to things like human trafficking and assisted suicide, legalizing prostitution and drug addiction? Yes. Do you think that those are messages that can also be consistent with the gospel? Absolutely. I'm not suggesting that you surrender one for the other. It's not either or, it's both and. And if we want to minister to the communities in which we're in, then we're going to have to begin to speak in stronger ways to a lot of these issues. I'll tell you, in my town, we're dealing with a major opioid crisis, as I'm sure many of you are. I didn't realize how bad it was until I had a son serving in the volunteer fire department. And now I listen to all of those calls, and I know how many overdoses are occurring in my little town of Lima. And I mean, we're a little town, man. We're a few thousand people. And it just seems like every time a call comes in, it's an overdose. It's a problem. My pastor's wife serves on the ambulance crew. My son serves in the fire crew. And so I'm hearing stories time and again of this kind of stuff happening. Now, great. We have opportunities now to minister to people in their brokenness, right? And this is what the mindset we want to take and what we're doing. So I want to challenge you to think about, as we deal with legislative matters, that we are also ministering to people in their brokenness and not running from the issues, but being able to clearly articulate them and talk about them even from the pulpit. To help you with that, I brought some literature on that table with a few issues that are coming up. And if you want to know more about them, I put a couple of sample position papers out there. Did you know that New York is looking to actually outlaw private health insurance? You just have one government plan. Everybody would have it. The Healthy Teens Act would actually be a funding stream for Planned Parenthood in your local public schools. We're told that $10 million would be a drop in the bucket to allow Planned Parenthood to come into your public schools and teach sex ed to your students. I know some of you are saying, well, I homeschool or I have Christian school. That's right. But most of the kids in your programs and most of the kids in your churches and your communities are not homeschooled in Christian schools. And a part of loving our neighbor is also remembering those students as well. How about pregnancy center disclosures? Albany has a bill that would require that your pro-life pregnancy center, upon first contact with a woman coming through the door, would notify them that they do not perform abortions, but here's where you can go to get an abortion. Can you imagine? Can you imagine if it was reversed, if upon first contact, before you go into Planned Parenthood, Planned Parenthood had to meet you at the door and say, we're only going to provide 99.6% of abortions, and this is what it'll charge, but if you want to talk to somebody about your options, go down here to this pro-life pregnancy center. Well, they would flip a lid. They'd never do that. But they're asking pro-life pregnancy centers to promote Planned Parenthood. Well, we obviously have a problem with that. And frankly, that vote is probably coming next year. And so this is going to move even faster. If you feel like you can't keep up with all that's happening, I feel your pain. But I have created a legislative session in review, which our office put together, and it's essentially the comprehensive look at matters of legislation in the last legislative session, so you can see what happened. And then for 2020, I just have a number of things I'm going to leave on the table you can pick up. Some of them are with assisted suicide. Now, when you pick up our assisted suicide materials, you're going to notice that there aren't a lot of Bible verses in there because we're working with a diverse coalition of people. I have atheists that are part of this coalition. And they're grabbing these materials. We're all using these. So we have common messaging as we're trying to fight this as a coalition effort. And, you know, we're working with people that are atheists. I've got some Jewish folks in that committee. I work with a number of Catholic folks that are in there. A lot of disability rights people are involved with the work as well. And these are some great things you can do, resources that if you want to take your message and deal with this topic, you can simply supply this in your bulletin as well and put that information in there. That's good. And then also just the abortion stuff. I did bring a couple of things regarding that that are on the table as well. I would encourage you to take a look at those things. I've got about, I think, 3 minutes left. I don't know. I'm looking at my clock wondering what I got. Yeah, Brian? Okay, good, even 10. See, that's what I wanted to hope for. See, that's how we negotiate in politics today. And, yep, I said 3, he says 10. He means a half an hour. Let's go, all right? So, I know time is short, but how about some questions and answers? What have I not addressed that I can address for you? Well, what do you want to know about? Yes? Yeah, so we have a radio program we call, everything we do is kind of branded the Albany Update. So if you're looking for our website, it's albanyupdate.com. We also have a podcast, so you can catch us through podcasts. I have a 15-minute radio program that goes on. It's on Google Play, it's on iTunes, it's on iHeartRadio if you use those. So you can find our podcasts on there. And each week, we basically give you a 15-minute roundup of what's happening around the state or the nation from a distinctly Christian perspective. And so I would encourage you to do that. Also, there's this thing called radio. And people who listen to Mars Hill Network, if you listen to Family Life Network, we do the Capital Connection on Friday afternoons with Family Life. Mars Hill airs our daily 60-second commentaries. And then the 15-minute program, which is also our podcasts. The little thing that most people don't realize, and I'm surprised nobody's ever picked up on this, But the commentaries that I send out through our weekly email, and you can subscribe to those at albanyupdate.com, or you can simply text the word freedom to 22828. That's right, text the word freedom to 22828. Did I say freedom to 22828? If you do that, you sign up to receive our emails, you get the transcripts for that program. You know, now I ad-lib a little bit. There's a little improv in a radio program. But essentially, you get all the same information, but you get it in the written format. It's the top five articles on our website each week. So, you know, that's kind of what it is. Our daily commentaries become a longer program, become an email. And I would really encourage you to do that. It's just a way to stay informed with the issues you need to watch with days to come. In fact, this week's article, one of the hot topics is the HPV vaccination. Because this is different even in the last one. Regardless of where people stood in the last repeal of the religious exemptions, this is a clear parental rights violation. Because now we're saying that your student cannot attend school, public or private, unless they receive a vaccination against a sexually transmitted disease. That's insane. Now, you may support or oppose the HPV vaccination. That's up to you to decide, because I believe you're a parent, you have parental rights. But to mandate that my daughters, before they can go in the sixth grade, and my son now, by the way, although they're much older than that, but to say to our sons and our daughters that you cannot go to school unless you receive a vaccination against a sexually transmitted disease, it's not communicable. If somebody in this room was sitting here with HPV, you wouldn't get it from sitting next to them. And frankly, if the type of activity that would transmit that was occurring in the classroom, we got bigger problems we got to deal with, right? And this is where Albany is heading next. So, someone else. Yes?
How are you? How's your organization financed?
Yep. I'm independently wealthy, and so... yeah, okay, yeah, not at all. I appreciate that. We're about a $500,000 organization. So on the educational side, where we can offer tax-deductible receipts, New Yorkers Family Research Foundation is funded by individuals. And so people will just support us. The mean gift to our organization is $86.40. So we are supported by thousands of people across the state at small dollar amounts, which I love, because I know organizations like mine where people write $250,000 checks and $1 million checks. And if you want to be the first church to do that, I'm willing to try it. But But really, it's a lot of people that just individually give. Now, on the lobbying side, New Yorkers for Constitutional Freedoms, it's about $150,000 a year for that, and that's churches. Churches put us in their missions budget or in their general budget. I don't really care where you put me. I just love it when I'm in your budget. And they support us as a church because you're already tax-exempt, and we represent churches in our work, and so we've been doing it that way since 1982. It's worked out real well. The average church is about a $100 monthly gift that comes to us, but churches of all sizes. We are available to speak in your church. If you want to hear more about ministry, I'd love to come and share and give you an opportunity to come on board with us as well. Yeah. Pastor.
Are we live?
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Real deep voice now.
All right. I'll give you my Brian King voice.
That's right, yes.
I went to one of the legislative days, this was several years ago, and met with one of our representatives up in Albany who was on a local level, mayor in the upper part of our county, and then he moved to Albany and worked up there. And when we went in with our pastor and spoke with him about some of the moral issues that were at stake, asked him about what we can do, and he said the biggest problem is most of the lawmakers will attend to the voice of the people. Right. And he says the minority is screaming, the majority is silent.
Yeah.
And so the issues, he said, the biggest thing you can do is let your voice be heard. People need to be speaking up and need to be addressing the issues and need to be going to... He eventually made a bid for the governorship, and I'm friends with him.
Yeah.
Again, there, I think we need to take steps on our end to certainly let our voice be heard.
Yeah.
And... another issue, too, it was interesting that my wife and I are now guardians for my great niece. And it's a different dynamic because her dad says that she's 7 years old, and her dad is demanding that we send her to public school. Now, we went to Christian school, and our kids did, too. So it's a different world out there. We're becoming more... adjusted to what they're doing there in the public school. And What I find most interesting is as the principal is sending out these newsletters by the week about these different character traits that we want our children to have, for the most part, they are great character traits.
Tolerance, if equality, just not purity.
All these things to be kind to each other, to love each other. And and I said, you know, what they really are looking for is they're looking for Christianity.
Yeah.
They want their kids to but they don't want the restrictions of Christianity. They just want the benefits of what would become from that. So I think there's hope. I think we just need to.
There is hope, and that's what, you know, we struggle with that sometimes because we have a hard time seeing it because of our reality. But as God's people, we ought to understand that we don't always see things simply as the reality that is not always what is, right? And, you know, it seems to me there was a time where there was one who thought he was surrounded and powerless and about to be overcome, and then his spiritual eyes had to be opened to see that God's holy angels were there to protect and to deliver. And I feel that way as a state. You know, as I'm traveling the state, I tell people I believe we're going to be a pro-life state. I do. We're going to be a pro-life state. Now, some of you may not live to see it. I understand that. And I don't mean that as a joke. I mean that sincerely. It's going to be a long process to get there generationally. But I believe it's going to happen because the numbers are moving our way. Man, the younger and younger kids are today, they are more and more pro-life than generations before them. The work of all this pro-life work in our churches and our pregnancy centers, everything's catching up. The ultrasound, you cannot look at that anymore and say it's not a baby. It's a baby. You got Planned Parenthood people now calling it a baby in various occasions, not often, but they get it. They're like, we still think it's okay to kill the baby. It's the mother's choice, you know? I'm like, it just shake my head. It's happening. The reason why the Abortion Expansion Act passed last January is because they know it's changing. Because their time is short. They had to pass that now before Roe is overturned. Because when Roe is overturned and it returns to a state rights issue, people are going to wake up. And they're not going to have the numbers they have now. And those numbers are already shifting. A generation is dying off that was rapidly pro-abortion. And the one that's rising up is not as much. And less with each succeeding generation. And so I believe we will be a pro-life New York. If I had more time, I'd share more about our plan for that. But if you happen to be near Brooks House of Barbecue, we'll be talking about that Friday night if you're looking to come out for dinner. And that'll be Friday night or in Kingston on Saturday morning. So, all right, how about one or two more questions real quick? All right, over here.
Do you see any harm in influencing the Democratic Party back towards some kind of conservative?
See, now I want to talk about what I just told you I wasn't going to talk about. Great question, yeah.
Do you see at least some kind of them moving forward?
Yeah, I do. I believe that it's someday we are going to see where every party is going to be pro-life in this nation. And I mean that. It's not going to happen tomorrow, like, you know, or next month, but it's going to happen. Because there was a time in which there were political parties that supported a right to slavery. But as the nation woke up to how abhorrent that was, it changed. And today, there is no party, right, that would dare stand up and say we have a pro-slavery platform, right? Just like you couldn't stand up and say we have a pro-human trafficking platform, right? You can't do that. And the numbers are changing. Things are moving. The problem is there's a primary process that's weeding out on the Democrat side. And it happens on the Republican, too. But you weed out the people that are pro-life in that party. So here's what we need to do, and this is what our organization is committed to do going forward. We purchased a building in Rochester. Long story short, we are renovating it now. We hope to have it done by the end of the year, and we're going to start offering classes at our campus in Rochester, which will also be broadcast across the internet, and then will eventually be recorded, and we'll build an on-demand library system. So when someone in your church says to me, I'm thinking of running for office, you can send them to me, and we can have a vetting process, and if we think they'll be a credible candidate, we want to train them how to run for office. We also want to train campaign activists. So if this is a person who wants to get involved in public relations, we'll train them how to do media. This is a person who is a graphic or web designer, we'll train them how to use it for political purposes, how to help a candidate. You know, we're going to do it as the C3 educational side because it's nonpartisan, but we're going to be training people so that one day when you call me up and you say, hey, I'm in Rockland County and I'm a Democrat, and we meet with you and you check out good at my issues, I'll work and I'll assist you to run in a Democratic Party, to run as a candidate in that party and seek to try to win and be there. There's places in this state where the only way you're going to win is as a Democrat. The numbers are just not there. In fact, the morning article in Rochester Democrat and Chronicle this morning was how much more the Democrat enrollment is up in this state. And I really don't care about Republican or Democrat. I just care about the principles. And if you can be pro-life and pro-family and pro-religious freedom and parental rights and all those things as a Democrat and stick to that and actually move that party to where it needs to be, I'll support you in that. We do support some candidates in that position. And, you know, with Senator Reverend Ruben Dee, as you may remember, he'd speak at our legislative day. He's now running for Congress in the district next to AOC. There's a pastor taking on AOC in her district right now as a Democrat. You know, and he's got a chance, you know, it's probably a slim one, but he's got a chance. But, you know, little by little, these Democrats are taken on. Can you imagine what would happen if all of a sudden AOC was taken out by this Hispanic pastor, you know, like a shockwave that would send? Now, remember, I'm not with him on everything. I mean, he's currently a city council member as well, and he spends money like a drunken Democrat. I get it. But he's, but on social values, he's there. And, you know, that's, I'll work with you where I can and be co-belligerent. All right, one more question. Dean.
How are Dwayne and Nancy?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's an easy one. Dwayne and Nancy Motley were the founders of our organization. I'm the second generation of leadership. Dwayne is now in his 80s, as is Nancy. Their health is good. Dwayne is still driving bus, actually. He's not involved in ministry anymore, but he is doing driving bus for some part-time work. They're still traveling. They cared for his mom, who was in her 90s, almost 100, until just a few years ago. So now they're kind of footloose and fancy-free teenagers, and they're traveling around and doing different things they've not been able to do for all these many decades. And so they're doing well, though. Yeah. Dwayne's the only person who's gone through prostate cancer and came out stronger than he went in. It's really been remarkable to see how God's just strengthened him over the years. Yeah. Amen. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm not running out. I'll be at the table out there for any more specific questions. But thanks for your ministry, and thank you for the opportunity.